wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Bill Resnick talks with Juan Carlos Ordonez of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. Jan Hawkins speaks with Diana Meisenhelter, Extinction Rebellion PDX organizer. And Patricia Kohlberg reads from Lane Wyndham's article, Why There's More Labor Media Coverage. First up, Bill Resnick speaking with Juan Carlos Ordonez of the Oregon Center for Public Policy about why so many hugely profitable companies pay no taxes and what should be done about it. Here's Bill Resnick and Juan Carlos Ordonez for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hi, Juan Carlos Ordonez. Welcome to KABU.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me on the show.
Juan Carlos is the media director, also does a lot of research at the Oregon Center for Public Policy that concentrates on the economy and the situation of the bottom 60% or so of residents of the state who live precariously. For many, most actually, for them, losing a job, one severe illness, maybe a divorce could plunge them into destitution. Today we are going to talk about taxes and how they fit into our system of extreme inequality. So, Juan Carlos, political theory understands taxes paying for the public programs that protect society from capitalism's single-minded drive for profit that generates extreme inequality and environmental destruction in the United States. That's at least the liberal political theory. But today, the capacity of the U.S. state to function effectively towards those goals is in doubt. Recently, Ron Wyden in Oregon, Biden, White House have introduced modest but meaningful tax increases, arguing that they will pay for expanding support for the poor and a great expansion of renewable energy that is a head start on saving the planet. Will these pass? Well, that's a long shot as the world gets meaner and hotter, but things can be done. That's how we'll conclude today. Juan Carlos, I've read that the poor pay a higher proportion of their meager incomes in taxes than the rich do. How does that happen? Let's start generally with the problems of most people and the problem with taxes.
Yes, it is the case that when we look at the situation at the national level, we see that something very strange has happened in the recent years, in that the super rich, the very richest 400 individuals today pay a lower overall tax rate than actually anyone else in the country, including the poorest. And this is when you factor in not just federal income taxes and federal taxes, but also state taxes that we pay here in Oregon, as well as local taxes. So when you look at the totality of taxes, it turns out that some of the richest people in the country, people like Bill Gates and folks like that, Elon Musk, pay less overall as a group than the very lowest earning Americans. This is also a situation that we see here in the state of Oregon. And in fact, the situation is in some ways more extreme, in that it's not just that the very richest pay the lowest share, but also here in Oregon, the lowest earning 20% of Oregonians pay the highest overall taxes out of their income than anyone else when you add up all state and local taxes. So in Oregon, we have an overall what's called a regressive tax structure that asks proportionally more of the poor than of the rich. And we see that at the national level as well, at the very top, where the multi-billionaires pay less than anyone else.
Let's get a little bit more detail on how the tax system contributes.
Yes, and maybe I can step back for a second and just reflect on the fact that our tax system, as you pointed out at the beginning, is how we pay for the vital public services that create quality of life for everyone: education, transportation, housing, healthcare, a whole array that provides, it really is, are the foundation of our society. And when the tax system is weak, when it's not working well, it bodes poorly for the kind of infrastructure that creates that quality of life. Just a good example, our nation and our state have been unable to pay for preschool education for all children. And that's a real lack of social infrastructure. So that's just one example, but there's many ways in which we have been failing to invest the necessary resources into our public infrastructure. But in addition to that, the tax system, in addition to paying for those public services, historically the tax system has been a check on concentrated economic power. And today we see that that tax system has been weakened. And so over the past few decades, those changes to our tax system, the weakening of the tax system, has contributed to the extreme concentration of income and wealth at the very top. So that's very important to point out. And there's different mechanisms for, really, when we look at the big picture, there's certain themes. There's no one reason why we've gotten to this situation, but there's several very important sort of trends that we've seen that lead to this situation. One of those is when we look at the difference in terms of how wages are taxed compared to income from assets, income produced by wealth. So, for example, the vast majority of Oregonians and the vast majority of Americans make their income from a paycheck. I mean, that's what most of us pay the bills, right? But for the wealthy, most of their income comes from their assets. So from the corporate stock that they own, from dividends, things like this that generates their income. And at the national level, those kinds of incomes from wealth get taxed at a lower rate. So folks may know that, for example, at the national level, capital gains gets a much lower tax rate than income from a paycheck. That's part of the reason. Another reason is just simply what's considered income. So, for example, if you own, like someone like Jeff Bezos, who owns a big portion of Amazon, and it's owned in the form of stock, his wealth can grow, and as long as he doesn't sell that stock, he's not going to be taxed on it. And so that factor alone, that the wealthy can postpone paying taxes, can mean that ultimately all that income, the growth of that income that then turns into wealth, is never taxed. And that basically, it means that often when they die, that income will never be taxed. And so that's yet another factor for how we are where we are, where there's so much wealth and income concentrated at the top. So another important sort of structural factor that explains why our tax system has become quite inequitable is tax avoidance, both by the wealthy and by corporations. So in terms of corporations, we know that they have been playing all kinds of games in terms of hiding their profits. And one of the main maneuvers that they use is simply artificially shifting profits from where they are earned here in the U.S. and here in Oregon, and artificially shifting them to somewhere outside the U.S., another jurisdiction that levies little or no corporate income tax. Often this might be, you know, the Cayman Islands or Bahamas, but often places like, you know, the Netherlands or Ireland. But they basically create shell corporations that then they pass, for example, intellectual property to that subsidiary and play shenanigans in terms of transferring the profits that were earned here in the U.S. and artificially shifting them overseas.
Right. All of that is just paper changes. There's no change in who buys it, who makes it, who where the company is actually located. It's just a lot of paper. They incorporate some dummy corporation in Ireland. Ireland is has been one of the major. They're now being corralled by the European Union to some extent, but they just shift the company and they make that company the owner of some intellectual property or whatever it is, and then all the profits get taxed at their rate, which is very close to zero.
Yes, and what's really revealing is that when CEOs report to their shareholders the profits, they report huge profits. We have been living for quite a number of years where corporate profits have been at a very high level, and yet there are many corporations that report paying zero in taxes. And in fact, in 2020, there were 55 companies listed in the Fortune 500. In other words, 55 of the nation's biggest companies paid zero in federal income taxes, even though they were reporting to their shareholders healthy earnings. And this, by the way, included Nike, which is headquartered here in Oregon. And, you know, that year, Nike didn't pay a dime in federal income taxes, even though they reported $2.9 billion in pre-tax income that year. And in fact, Nike that year not just didn't pay any taxes, they got 100 about $100 million in tax rebates from the federal government. So taxpayers were, in fact, subsidizing Nike. So shifting profits overseas is part of the equation. Part of it is a number of tax loopholes that exist. So just to give you a sense of it, it's called accelerated depreciation in terms of if a company invests in new equipment, you know, traditional accounting rules, they can depreciate that equipment. But for the tax rules, they're able to do it much more quickly, and it just gives them more so than what normally is the case. So they're able to sort of play by different rules under the tax system. And there's just a lot of tax loopholes that exist and new ones that have been created over the decades that not just allows them to reduce their tax bill, but it gives opportunities for their tax lawyers and accountants to devise new ways to sort of exploit the complexity of the tax code to expand those loopholes even more than was initially intended. And by the way, these tax loopholes didn't arise out of nowhere. These are tax loopholes that corporations go and lobby Congress and the Oregon legislature for. So it's like they lobby for these loopholes, then they get put into place, then they take advantage of these loopholes, and then they further exploit them by sending their armies of tax lawyers and accountants to find new ways to further stretch them, if you will. And the other thing to keep in mind is that there's also been a reduction of the corporate tax rate over the years. And with respect to rich Americans, that has also been the case. Back during the Dwight Eisenhower years in the 1950s, we had a maximum personal income tax rate of about 91%. That was the top rate. Today, that rate is below 40%, and that's just the tax rate that's on paper. But as we discussed before, the reality is that the very rich in some years have been paying nothing. And in fact, there was a really explosive report that was published by ProPublica last year. They were able to get a hold of not the direct tax returns of the richest people, but basically information gleaned from those tax returns by the billionaires of this country. And what they found was that many of them in some recent years have paid absolutely nothing in federal income taxes, like zero. And we're talking about people like Jeff Bezos of Amazon, Warren Buffett, Elon Musk, who in some recent months, has overtaken Jeff Bezos as the richest person. So we're talking about the absolutely super richest people in this country, wealthiest people, that have been paying nothing. You and I have been paying more in federal income taxes, and the listeners will have been paying more in federal income taxes than many of the super billionaires.
That's also true, it seems to me, of a fairly large number of people. It's not just those super billionaires. It's your average billionaire who also has, there are tax firms around the country who advertise themselves as having the latest loopholes, basically. And those people, in fact, get hired. They put their names on their tax return. And the IRS has been so hollowed out by cuts in their appropriations and therefore cuts in their staff. They are no longer not just examining, but examining carefully. I mean, not just examining carefully, but even examining those tax returns, because they do not have the staff with the expertise has been hollowed out. And because if they, in fact, bring a corporation to tax court, their lawyers are outperforming and no more and have made a whole set of arguments. The IRS is just outmanned and outthought, it seems to me, although they've now passed a modest increase for the first time in like 40 years of the for IRS personnel. Those are all ways that the rich can increase their income, and they have the money to hire the staff to influence our legislators. It's a nice game while it lasts. In fact, maybe we should get to that. There are just so many loopholes. Individual companies go to their congressperson, right? Like Nike will go to I'm not sure that Wyden or Markley would actually play that game, but certainly Packard used to, and Smith and the others. They just put in individual language in the tax code that would only benefit Nike because of all the particulars. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO, talking to Juan Carlos Ordonez, who's the media director and researcher at the Oregon Center for Public Policy, that concentrates on the economy and the situation of the bottom 60% or so of residents who live precariously, with many winding up destitute. We so far discussed the gross unfairness of the tax code, its inadequacies, indeed how and why that's happened, the enormous power of the rich now, and which specific provisions must be changed. And Carlos, let's get to what can be done and how it can be done to change the, not just the tax code actually, but change the whole way the resources necessary to run a decent government, what should be done.
Well, there is obviously a lot to be done. Maybe we can begin by focusing on what ought to be done at the federal level. So thinking about the structural causes of how we are where we are that we discussed before. So, you know, in terms of the difference between how income from a paycheck is taxed differently from income from wealth, income from the sale of stocks and bonds and other capital gains, a simple solution would be to just tax them at the same rate, right? So that's fairly straightforward. And certainly Senator Wyden has proposed doing just that in the past, and that would be an excellent, obvious step. But there's also a more complicated problem, which is the fact that you can be sitting on earnings on your stock, on your, you know, someone like Jeff Bezos can be sitting on massive growth of his wealth from the stock of Amazon that he owns, but he's never sold it, so he may end up dying and never paying a dime on it. So what to do about it? Well, this has been a discussion that's been going on for some time now, and President Biden actually released a few days ago a tax plan that begins to take that issue head on. So, for example, one of the things that his proposal would do would be to impose a minimum tax on the super wealthy. So, and we're talking here about a very tiny sliver of folks, the wealthiest 0.01% of households. And these are households that have wealth of at least $100 million. So I don't know anybody who has wealth of $100 million. They're few and far between. So these households would be required to pay at least a minimum of 20% on their income, including their income on their unrealized capital gain. So if I'm a billionaire and my stock portfolio grows by several million in a year, even though I haven't sold, this would apply to those gains. And there's rules as to how exactly it would be implemented. So that's part of the solution for sure, addressing that question of wealth. Another structural solution that hasn't gotten as much attention but has to be on the table is strengthening the estate tax. And the estate tax historically has been how the nation has taxed vast fortunes that would pass on to heirs and has been a check on the preventing the creation of an American aristocracy, right? But over the decades, again, through the lobbying by the super rich, there's been a weakening of the estate tax. So strengthening both in terms of the rate that gets paid on estates that are affected, but also on the exemption of the estate tax, the amount that gets sort of passed on tax-free has increased massively over the decades. So addressing those two issues, strengthening the estate tax would be an important step for sure. There's other proposals to do similar to what the Biden tax plan does more broadly for basically a way of getting at taxing wealth is an important conversation. And as you mentioned, the IRS has been hit very hard in terms of defunding over the decades. You know, there was a report that came out last year showing that of the 4 million or so partnerships that exist in the country. And partnerships can be very opaque kind of corporate entities. They can be very large. The Trump Organization is probably a partnership. So they can be massive organizations that own other partnerships, and yet only a tiny amount of partnerships get audited any one year. So the IRS just simply doesn't have the capacity to look at these complicated corporate entities and audit them. By comparison, the poor get audited at a much higher rate. People who receive the earned income tax credit, a tax credit for low-income workers, they're much more likely to get audited than a partnership. And it's just simply because it's easier for the IRS. They don't have the investigative capacity to really look at these complicated vehicles. As you said, they're completely outgunned by the wealthy and corporations. So putting more resources into the IRS is definitely a must do. You mentioned that there was an increase in funding for the IRS recently, and that is in fact the case. The Biden tax plan would do even more, so that's definitely a step forward. But we really need the IRS to be able to look to see who is avoiding taxes and how they're doing it, and really clamping down on all that tax avoidance and evasion. And we can also look at corporations, and the Biden tax plan also calls for raising the corporate income tax rate from 21% to 28%. That would be a very good step. There's discussions internationally to establish a corporate minimum, in essence, of 15%. So the Senate would need to ultimately ratify such a treaty, such an agreement. So there's definitely discussions there, but obviously there's a lot to do. And let's not forget, there's a lot to do here in Oregon.
Yeah. Juan Carlos, you've been terrific at summarizing all of the problems and, in fact, the solutions within the tax code as it exists. Many of the things can be changed to raise a whole lot more money. My sense is that the challenges to not just the U.S., but to the whole planet are now so great and require so much resources to deal with. That is the environmental destruction that humans have caused, that's now led to global warming that could go out of control any year now. Say the climate scientists were really living on borrowed time. That's going to take a whole another level of money, and it'll be really have to do a mobilization for war when, in fact, the government prints money, and a war economy can be very good for the poor, actually, because they get employed. It's a super productive economy, which we could have, and we could, in fact, build the devices that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It seems to me, though, that at this point, the key to it is not just naming the taxes and the threats. The key to it is building movements that would change the character of our governing, the character and characters of the people who are representing us in the legislatures and in the bodies authorized to make the law. And nothing can substitute for a great uprising of a left movement that would take on those power structures and, in fact, begin operating to literally save our lives. I'm afraid that's probably another conversation, Juan Carlos, but give us your last words.
Yeah, I think that you hit on something that's right on, and that we know what the solutions are. I mean, that's not a big mystery. Yes, it's complicated, but the big picture is fairly clear in terms of what the problem is and the approaches that we need to take to solve what's plaguing our tax system. So it ultimately does come to a political question, a question of political will. And in order to move elected leaders to do what needs to be done, yes, it does take a social movement, no question about it. It means everyone, or at least a vast majority of Americans and Oregonians, demanding change. And as much as I hate connecting it to war, we do know that, for example, some of the big changes that were made to our tax system that improved them for the better were actually carried out during times of emergencies like war. During the Civil War, we saw the first income tax put in place. Certainly during the Great Depression and World War II, we saw big increases and improvements to the tax system to address those big needs. Certainly the climate crisis that we face, the mass economic insecurity that Americans and Oregonians face, vast groups of folks who are struggling to pay the bills. These are the kinds of crises that hopefully can motivate enough Americans to demand and achieve change.
Juan Carlos Ordonez, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you so much, Bill. Always a pleasure.
I said to my Uncle Sam, old man taxes, here I am, and he was glad to see me. Mr. Small Fry, yes indeed. Lower brackets, that must be, and he was glad to see me. I paid my income tax today. I never felt so proud before to be right there with millions more who paid their income tax today. I'm squared up with the USA. I paid my income tax today.
That was Gene Autry with Jimmy Wakely's trio and Lou Bring's orchestra singing Irving Berlin's I Paid My Income Tax Today from 1942 on Gene Autry's Melody Ranch radio show. It followed Bill Resnick and Juan Carlos Ordonez. Up next, Jan Hocken talks with Diana Meisenhelter about a rally in downtown Portland this Wednesday, April 6th, in conjunction with the Scientist Rebellion. Diana Meisenhelter is a longtime labor, environmental, racial, and economic justice and community development organizer who has advanced degrees in ecological systems as well as social and labor history. In retirement, she volunteers full-time with Extinction Rebellion PDX on climate justice issues. Here's Jan Hocken speaking with Diana Meisenhelter for the Old Mall Variety Hour.
Welcome to KABU, Diana Meisenhelter.
Thank you.
Well, you've been a social justice activist in Portland for decades, and in recent years, an organizer with Extinction Rebellion Portland, or XR PDX. 2 years ago, XR and other climate justice groups succeeded in getting the Portland City Council to declare a climate emergency. This was an important sign of progress in and of itself. But this Wednesday, April 6th, a rally will be held to confront the city for its failure to enact a meaningful climate plan. Organizers for the rally are also taking on some of the groups that are blocking progress. Diana, give us some background on what's been happening since the mayor declared a climate emergency and what this rally is all about.
Okay, so this Wednesday, April 6th, there'll be a local action that starts at 4 p.m. at 121 Southwest Salmon Street. And this is in conjunction with the Global Scientists Rebellion, because this week, the latest installment of the International Panel on Climate Change will be released, and the news is dire. All evidence points to both more rapid climate chaos than originally anticipated, and that leaders haven't done near enough to hold the line at 1.5 degrees centigrade, and thus the consequences of these actions will be unthinkable ecocide and genocide, as food and potable water sources are threatened, as well as from extreme weather, heat, fires, and other climate-related catastrophes. So on Wednesday, led by local scientists, caring citizens will meet outside the Portland Business Alliance offices to demand that they stop obstructing local climate initiatives. And then we'll march to City Hall to demand that the city create a plan with concrete steps towards 10% annual reductions of greenhouse gas emissions. 2 years ago, the city council declared a climate emergency, but has little concrete to show yet in terms of actual reductions or policies even to reduce carbon emissions. We want clarity in the upcoming budget hearings that we expect the city to develop strong policies for both reducing greenhouse gas emissions and climate resiliency efforts, as the city does not seem to be proposing sufficient resources, especially in terms of the former. Portland Business Alliance has attacked the Portland Clean Energy Fund in a self-interested attempt to discredit the important work being done by the PCF coalition, calling for ludicrous freezing and basic reallocation of the fund in opposition to the framework that was set up by a voters initiative passed by a large margin of Portland citizens, like 65%. Behind the scenes, Portland Business Alliance and other powerful business leaders have worked to effectively kill the Portland Clean Air Protection Act, upsetting since nearly 40% of BIPOC folks in Portland live within 2 kilometers of the 10 biggest polluter point sources. Member organizations like Northwest Natural are suing the state for their climate protection plan. And No Friend to the Homeless, Portland Business Alliance, continues with policies to harass and sweep the most vulnerable members of our community to the effects of climate chaos, like the heat dome experienced last summer, particularly hard on the homeless. Ironically, their so-called clean and safe contract that the Business Alliance has had troubling and unresolved city audit findings, and yet they have the audacity to bully the newly emergent PSEF program's audit. The PSEF Climate Justice Fund is critical for addressing racial and economic inequities within our community as we transition to clean energy, and it addresses climate change in real substantive ways. Now more than ever, it's important for those who care about mitigating climate chaos to stand up to these Business Alliance bullies and to pressure our elected leaders to take emission reduction actions. So please join us and help us spread the word about April 6th, 4 p.m. at 121 Southwest Salmon.
Thank you, Diana. That was a very succinct, disheartening review of some of the high points and the low points of what's been happening the last few years. The Portland Business Alliance has driven some of the local media coverage that's been critical of the Coalition of Communities of Color and its management of the Portland Clean Energy Fund. And yet when you go onto the audit, the website itself with the audit, it's much more supportive of the management of the fund, noting the its positive steps it's taken and the enormous challenges it faces in implementing this new program. I was also struck by something else in the audit that perhaps you could help explain. Quote, the legislation that is around the establishment of the Portland Clean Energy Fund tied goals for the program to the city's climate action plan, but it expired in 2020. This climate action plan set a vision for Portland's local climate strategies and included 20 objectives and 247 action plans. And the audit goes on to say that this fund has not received the kind of support or guidance from the city that it needs. Can you explain that part of the audit and how it relates to what you're demonstrating about this week?
Well, that is exactly what we're demonstrating about this week. Let's go back to the PBA to start with. They opposed the PSEF fund from the beginning because it's a 1% surcharge on businesses that have over $500,000 in sales. But the fund itself is a first in the nation. It's like a model for other situations, but it's kind of starting from the ground up. And the city auditor, like you said, says that what we're seeing is exactly what you'd expect from a startup. Nevertheless, they've been doing amazing steps like the jobs training green construction program and heat pumps for low-income families and trying to address the tree canopy and the improve energy efficiency for low-income families, which also helps with costs and food security measures. But with all these amazing programs that are actually doing concrete things, the city itself has not been putting together concrete policies. They've been talking about their decarbonization pathways now for a couple of years, but the model still isn't even developed, much less the concrete steps in the critical areas that need to be happening, you know, buildings and energy, land use and transportation. They're just getting the build shift committees off the ground, but there's been nothing in terms of actual concrete goals. And so while we have these sort of, you know, get to 50% by 2030 or 2050, whatever, you know, these long-term goals are, we've already lost 2 years. And the newly leaked report that's coming out on Monday says that basically greenhouse gas emissions have to peak within 4 years, which is like the middle of this decade. And within this decade, it has to get to at least 50% reduction. So that means we have to have concrete policies in place to every year decrease the amount of emissions that we're doing if we have any chance. Because right now we're at about a 1.1% increase. Scientists are now saying it's going to be pretty much impossible to keep it to 1.5% or 1.5 degrees centigrade increase. And yet, even at that level, 8% of farmland is no longer able to grow crops. And with each tenth of a degree of warming, basically, there's over a 4-time effect in terms of climate extremes.
And so, Diana,
Well, currently we're on a path for 2 to 4 degrees increase more than now. And so it's absolutely critical that we turn this around. And that's why we need the city to have concrete steps and policies in place. And like the audit said, that has not happened.
So Diana, what about the old political anthem, think globally, act locally? And I think that's part of the idea here is to understand your local struggles as part of something larger and the driving forces behind these petro countries and economies, including our own, and these local fights. How do you see this local resistance and pressure on the city councils as part of something larger that can give us some hope for envisioning a different future, a sustainable future?
Well, I guess Portland has kind of touted itself as a green city and as a model. And yet it's pretty appalling that we don't have policies in place that will do what needs to happen. And if it can't happen in Portland, I mean, what is our hope for the rest of the country and the world? We need to be the ones pushing for these changes and demanding them now. And already, you know, poorer nations are at far greater risk. Between 2010 and 2020, floods and droughts and storms killed 15 times more in wealthier nations, even though, you know, the poorer nations are the least responsible for these emissions.
And that's true locally as well.
Yeah. And so that's our, and yes, again, whether it's the results of COVID or any number of other things, it's the frontline communities that are always hit the hardest. And so all of us need to take, you know, both the moral and the ethical responsibility to do our part to make sure that these changes come about as quickly as possible, because we're in a dire place. And instead of decreasing, the emissions keep increasing. And that's true both in Portland as well as around the world right now.
Before we close, can you say a bit more about the scientists' rebellion here? There's been news coverage this past month about scientists around the globe who despair and continuing to document the decline of ecosystems and the decline of a livable planet. And as these industries steamroll movements as well, what is that? Does that imply a shift in the scientific community toward activism?
Yes, I think what scientists are saying is that it's been like really discouraging. They keep putting out more and more studies. They keep doing more research. They keep publishing all of these things, making very clear what the science says. And yet the leaders are not responding in the way that they should. And one scientist sort of explained the need for more direction this way. He says, like, you imagine two people sitting on a house and one turns to the other and calmly says, the house is on fire and the roof is about to collapse and kill us both. And then goes back to reading their newspaper. It would be completely unreasonable for the other to believe the threat, no matter how real it was. And so what the scientists are saying is we need to put our own bodies on the line. Some have even threatened to stop doing the research until they're listened to, because it is such a dire situation, both ethically and
politically. Yeah.
That action needs to happen right now.
So the hope is not in enlightened leaders, but in communities coming together and forcing politicians from the ground up to respond to the scope and scale of the climate emergency. So before we close, Diana Meisenhelter, just say again how people can find out more details about the event. That's this Wednesday, April 6th, 4 p.m., meeting in front of Say Where We're Meeting, and where people should go online to find out more of the details.
We'll be meeting at 121 Southwest Salmon, and then we'll be marching to City Hall, which is 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue. And you can go to the XRPDX website or Facebook page, which is xrpdx.org. And we hope that you'll join us and help us spread the word, because it's very important to get many folks as possible out there. We have to make this crisis impossible to ignore.
And we hope to have the media there as well. I know I'll gather up my camera crew as best I can to be there and join you and document this and to keep the pressure on the political and business communities here. Thanks so much for being with us today, Diana Meisenhelder.
Thank you so much, Jan. Thank you.
Hey, yo, Cabot, where you at, bro?
Trying to build walls, but who commit world crimes? Gassing us up while we pay more fines. Oh my, power to the people so the people gon' climb. We gon' keep flowing like the rivers in the sky. Generations of resistance be the reason for the rhyme.
Money spent just to bring the torture to our lives. Money spent just to see the tears in our eyes. Money spent to kill off and see us alone. Where's the money at? Cause how could we know? Money for the wealthy, abusive and white. Money for the powerful men who are high. Money which is spent spreading COVID-19. Money should be spent for a future that's free. Cause we are the ones marching for a change. We are the ones protesting for the same rights. Equity, peace and efficiency. Water and air. Just show us some decency. Terrible lies and empty promises.
Your money pours out dirty, drinking water given today. Where the man you to change? You try to hide from us, but we figured it out. Now that we know, we'll try to change, no doubt. Oh, here's your another problem, climate change. Our future disappear, where do you make a change? Don't say there's nothing we can do. People are dying, have you not got the clue? Stop using all the harmful machinery. We wanna see the money funded into frontline communities, numb to the fossil fuel industry.
Oh my,
so much
oh my,
control
really
is now, where the money
no
at?
Trying to build walls, but who commit world crimes? Gassing us up while we pay more fines. Oh my, power to the people so the people gon' climb. We gon' keep flowing like the rivers in the sky. Generations of resistance be the reason for the rhyme.
We're standing for a better world, like polar bears starving for food. You're leaving animals an unlivable home, like you're leaving us an unlivable earth. Why fund for the end of our communities and not fund sustainability? We need investment smartly and then it will be art. We need to stop spending money on hurtful things. Replant the greenery so we can have a pretty scenery. Fossil fuels, police, all activities enforcing white supremacy. Need to go, need to protect our home. So where's the money at?
Callus has been using the money from teachers to harm our communities. His villain went to fossil fuel industry while censoring youth from reality. OPD and RPDs get paid for terrorizing when the money should be helping people in need, not feeding the pigs. Don't think I forgot about the governor Gavin Newsom, such a good giver, issuing fossil fuel permits like healthcare should be. Fasting for free, not getting all the little kids sick. They're afraid of people knowing the destruction they'll be funding. Greenwashing, they be showing and get mad when YBA confronts it.
They trying to build walls, but who commit world crimes? Gassing us up while we pay more fines. Oh my, power to the people so the people gon' climb. We gon' keep flowing like the rivers in the sky. Generations of resistance be the reason for the rhyme.
Hey yo, Cabot, where you at, bro?
Oh my, are they really for the people? Yeah, we see no signs. They tryna build walls, but who commit world crimes? Gassing us up while we pay more fines. Oh my, power to the people so the people gon' climb. We gon' keep flowing like the rivers in the sky.
That was Where's the Money At by Youth Versus Apocalypse here on the Old Mole Variety Hour. And Jan Hawken speaking with Diana Meisenhelter. Up next, Patricia Kohlberg reading from an article entitled Why There's More Labor Media Coverage by labor activist Lane Wyndham, as published online in Working Class Perspectives on March 14, 2022. Here's Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg, your well-read red for today. Public approval of unions tanked in 2009, registering at a mere 48%, the lowest rating since 1936, when Gallup began recording this measure. By 2021, however, that rating had climbed 20 points to 68%. This remarkable surge in public favor of unions comes at a time when union organizing and labor actions are exploding across the country and racking up important gains. So what has changed? Lane Wyndham, a veteran labor organizer and activist, argues that the economic crash of 2008 and the Occupy movement of 2011 ushered in a new era of public and media attention to inequality. Then along came the pandemic, which drew back the curtain on the misery of working class lives and the rapaciousness of U.S. corporations. A new generation of journalists has been eager to cover these changes, and their work has helped to shape the shifting perception of unions from backward-looking organizations to righteous institutions that battle for well-deserved and long-overdue working-class equality. Her article lends weight to the argument that grassroots organizing matters and contributes to social justice progress in ways that cannot always be anticipated. Lane Windham is the Associate Director of Georgetown University's Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, and is the author of Knocking on Labor's Door, Union Organizing in the 1970s and the Roots of a New Economic Divide. I'm going to read from her article entitled Why There's More Labor Media Coverage, which is published online in the Working Class Perspectives on March 14, 2022. Windham writes, "It seems like workers and their unions are in the news more than ever lately. Starbucks baristas, Amazon warehouse workers, John Deere strikers, and even New York Times tech workers who just unionized have all starred in the recent swell of labor coverage. The pandemic launched essential workers out of the media's shadows, making this largely black, brown, and female workforce much harder for reporters to ignore. Yet the shift in the media's coverage of labor started before the pandemic and even predates the current upsurge in union organizing. Why are we seeing this increase in working class and labor reporting, and how does it connect with larger shifts in how Americans view class itself? For many years, I did media outreach for the national AFL-CIO. When I started at the Federation in 1998, there were about 20 reporters on my A-list. By the time I left in 2009, there were three. Even in the early days, when the roster was more robust, it was extremely difficult to get stories about workers' grassroots struggles and protests into the corporate legacy outlets. Important labor stories just didn't get covered. For example, only one outlet covered the massive labor and environmental protests against the 2003 Free Trade Area of the Americas ministerial meetings in Miami. Police shot at unionists with rubber bullets, clubbed protesters, and tanks lined the streets. You probably haven't heard of this protest, because there was only one brief news story published. The issue went beyond the labor beat. Reporters in general only used the term working class during election season, when they dusted it off to track voting trends among white workers without college degrees. Though the media still has a long way to go to fully cover today's diverse working class, it gives far more attention to working class issues than it did, even when it doesn't use the word class. I couldn't believe it when so many reporters recently flocked to Bessemer, Alabama, to cover the Amazon warehouse workers' union election. So what changed? I suspect that the uptick of media coverage of workers and their unions is linked to larger shifts away from a dominant neoliberal consensus and also to changing understandings of class itself. This seismic shift started after the economic crash of 2008-2009 and inspired a new emphasis on inequality that fueled the Occupy Wall Street movement in 2011. These events shot holes in many tenets of the neoliberal consensus that all trade and globalization was good at any price, that shareholder value was the ultimate goal of the economy, that public goods were better privatized, that unions were Luddites who stood in the way of all this progress. These neoliberal tenets had held since the 1970s, but most people's lived experience did not bear them out. The idea that the 99% lost out to the 1% rang true for many, and their thoughts on what was fair began to change. Young people who entered this economy after the financial meltdown of 2008 found a working class world that was incredibly different from the one that baby boomers and Gen Xers entered. They came of age in a time when neoliberal thinking was losing its foothold and precarious contract work was much more normal. They weren't going to do as well as their parents had, and they knew it. Young people today are the demographic that is most supportive of unions. Recent Gallup polling found that 77% of people under 35 favor unions. The reporters driving the change in labor coverage are of this generation. Many got their start in the newly minted digital media platforms, which they then unionized. They also began reporting in a time when social media had dismantled the gatekeeping function at the legacy outlets that had long ignored labor. They began bringing their own experience as young people in a precarious economy to their reporting, and they focused in a new way on class. When the pandemic hit, this new cadre of labor reporters showed the virus's impact on the working class. Young reporters at digital outlets led the way, and the legacy news outlets followed. But it's not just the reporters who are changing. Their readers' worldview is changing, too. The neoliberal markets-fix-everything mindset had already taken a hit in the 2008 crash. Then, during the pandemic, many watched from the safety of home as essential workers, largely working-class people of color, braved the virus. They saw that these workers didn't get treated better or paid more for their labor. The stories that new labor reporters offered about workers and their experiences found an intense interest among readers. The new upsurge in labor media coverage is anchored in fresh awareness about class and its role in America today. A growing understanding that is stripped of the anti-communism that shaped ideas about class for much of the 20th century. It's not yet clear how fully this working class renaissance will develop. What is clear is that a new generation of labor reporters is standing ready to report on it. This increased coverage, in turn, may allow the next generation of worker activists to see their own movement's growth, and that may inspire even more to take a stand. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I've been reading from an article by Lane Wyndham on the dynamics between the media, the economy, grassroots organizing, and public perceptions of class. The article is entitled "Why There's More Labor Media Coverage" and was published online at Working Class Perspectives on March 13, 2022.
We must fight for from the cities and the farmlands to trenches full of mud. War has always been the boss's wiser. Brothers and our sisters in many far-off lands, there is power in a union. Now I long for the morning that I realize brutality and unjust laws cannot defeat us. But who'll defend the workers who cannot organize when the bosses send their lackeys out to cheat us? Speaks for money, the devil for his own. Who comes to speak for the skin and the bone? What a comfort to the
widow, a light to the child. There is power in our union.
Off of his 1986 release Talking with the Taxman About Poetry, that was Billy Bragg singing There Is Power in a Union, following Patricia Kohlberg's reading of Lane Wyndham's article Why There's More Labor Media Coverage. You can find that online in the March 14, 2022 edition of Working Class Perspectives. And this has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for April 4th, 2022. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Bill Resnick, Jan Hocken, Patricia Kohlberg, and their guests Juan Carlos Ordonez and Diana Meisenhelter. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in Time at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.